On this week's 51%, a study shows that college women could use more physical activity.
We know across the lifespan, but particularly in college, women get less physical activity on average than men.
And we remember an award-winning author who wrote about immigrant life. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Less than one half of college women achieve the daily level of physical activity recommended for weight control and overall health. But a study from the University of Scranton and Drexel University shows that there is considerable variation in physical activity across days, weeks, and months, though this variation rarely is measured. Dr. Danielle Arrigo is assistant professor of psychology at the University of Scranton and the study's lead author. She found that college women increased their exercise from their usual levels after feeling bad about their bodies and after perceiving that they overate. These relationships were independent of weight change and actual calorie intake, suggesting that self-perception is extremely important for physical activity. I spoke with Arrigo about her study and its potential impacts.
So this was an opportunity for me and for some collaborators to take a look at some data that had already been collected where physical activity was not the main outcome that was being looked at. But to try to, because we had so much of the data over a long period of time, to try to look in a really time-sensitive way at what was predicting physical activity, high physical activity and low physical activity for college women during the first couple of years of college, and to see are those predictors consistent over the first couple of years of college, and are they is physical activity changing as those change? We're used to examining really static predictors of physical activity. So are you the kind of person who, you know, has a certain personality characteristic or has a certain level of physical activity? This really says for the same person over time, your experiences are going to change and your physical activity changes along with those experiences.
So what did you find?
So basically what we found is that at and subsequent to times when college women report that their body satisfaction is pretty low relative to their normal. So this is all relative to what's normal for you. At times when their body image was particularly negative and at times when they perceived themselves as having overeaten or being really responsive to food in their environment, those were the times when they got the most physical activity, again, relative to their normal.
So what do you do with that information? How do you incorporate it into culling a healthier lifestyle?
So there are lots of potential implications. The first is that if you take the flip side of that, so trying to understand if college women, and maybe women more generally, that's still an open question, but definitely for college women, if they're exercising in response to not liking their appearance or thinking that they've overeaten, that's going to be highly variable over time. And one of the things we know about physical activity is it's of the most benefit if you're consistent over time. So trying to get one of the primary implications is that maybe those kinds of highly variable motivations for physical activity are not the ones that we should be relying on, and really trying to better understand how to help college women invest themselves in motivations for physical activity that are more consistent. So something like, regardless of how I feel about my body or regardless of how much I've eaten, I'm going to stay consistent with my physical activity because it's important to me for these other reasons, whether that's about overall health or stress management or it helps me just feel better about myself. That's going to be much more consistent over time than something like, well, I'm going to exercise just when I don't like the way my body looks.
So why college women? And I noticed that your samples focus on urban colleges. Why not rural?
So I think what you're identifying, first of all, is all of the work that's still left to do. So part of the reason we did it the way that we did it is that, again, these were data that had already been collected from a weight gain prevention study in college women. So the one reason to focus on college women is that we know across the lifespan, but particularly in college, women get less physical activity on average than men. Women are less consistent in their physical activity than men, and college behaviors, the health behaviors you engage in during college, are actually predictive of your long-term behavior. So if you're able to solidify really good behaviors in college, and more women are going to college, more and more young people in general are going to college, if we're able to capture this group and solidify healthy behaviors during that time period, it could bode well for across the lifespan. So this is something we're learning more about. There isn't a ton of data in this area, but what data we have suggest that if you look at behaviors during college and then you follow the same people 5 to 10 years later, there's a really high correlation between what they're doing in college and what they're doing afterward. So we also need to, of course, identify the people who are not who might have good health behaviors during college, but maybe are not keeping those up over the long term, and how we can help them maintain over time. One of the things that our prevention and intervention programs are really good at is helping people change their behaviors in the short term. It's a lot harder to help people maintain those behaviors over the long term. So I think one of the benefits of the study that we did is we looked at a long period of time, and we were able to see, first of all, that physical activity does vary over 2 years, and that variability is predicted by these inconsistent motivations. And as I mentioned, for women in particular, because they get less physical activity than men and because there's such a high risk of cardiovascular disease, particularly later in life if women are inactive, that's really sort of the public health significance of why I think it's important to solidify these behaviors as early in life as possible.
So on whose shoulders does this fall in terms of changing the outcome? Obviously, the women involved, but it's bigger than that, right?
So I think there are lots of potential stakeholders or organizations or levels of intervention that really could be helpful. Of course, there's the individual level that each of us has some control over our own behaviors, and that the more we can make people aware of what influences their behavior and give them the knowledge and power to change their own behaviors, that's always going to be helpful. But we're learning more and more about how the environment, without us realizing it, shapes our behavior, how social norms shape our behavior. And in those ways, college health promotion programs can be really helpful for creating a culture of health on college campuses where it is the norm and it is considered the cool and normal thing to do to engage in healthy behaviors. You mentioned looking at more rural areas, that's some follow-up work that really needs to be done. Are we seeing a trend that covers all demographics in college, or is this something that's really unique to urban areas? I think that's an open question that we need to investigate, and getting as many community resources as we possibly can, because of course we're also not able to say with certainty what's happening for people who are in this same age group who are not attending college. And those people are likely different from the ones who are participating in our studies. And so how would interventions and programs really need to be different and tailored for those groups? All of that work that it is being done, but we need to invest a lot of resources in trying to understand not just what happens generally, but really what does it take for this individual person? What kind of knowledge, what kind of skills, what kind of environment did they need to be successful? And what does success look like for them?
That's interesting, because I think of college, be it urban or rural, as a place where one needs to walk to class. I mean, you cannot park your car in the classroom. I mean, one needs to expend some level of energy. So I'm wondering why such a differential between men and women. Is it that men are more participatory in organized sports or even just throwing the ball around to de-stress? And excuse the stereotypical and gross generalizational nature of this, but are women more prone to sit around and talk rather than throwing that ball around?
I think there are a lot of reasons, and stereotypical or not, I think you're hitting on something that really the data would back up. But in general, for men, it's more normal to have a social event that is geared around some sort of physical activity. So whether it's throwing a ball around or joining an intramural frisbee team or just generally like going out for a walk that you know, men aren't necessarily power walking in college. But it's much more normative to hear college men talking about active events that they went to with their friends. Whereas for women, what's social about physical activity, women actually would prefer to engage in physical activity that has some sort of social component, but there isn't as much structure around that for women. So we hear a lot of women say, well, if I had someone I could go to the gym with, or if I had a class that I could take where there would be other people there who I would know, I'd be so much more comfortable than doing it by myself. So for guys, that might be the case, but they're not bringing that up as a barrier because those seem to already exist for them, or they're thinking about it a little bit differently than women are. But for women, the social component is a big barrier that we need to figure out, like, how do we catalyze this social behavior around going to the gym, around being more active when you're spending leisure time with your friends.
You know, of course we want healthy individuals, but I think particularly in the case of women, we have to be careful about the message we're sending about healthy versus body image, because that's such a big deal with women, right? I mean, we want to make sure that healthy is not being equated with necessarily being thin.
And that's really how a lot of my previous work fits into what I'm doing now, because a lot of what we were looking at stemmed from thinking about women's body image and their perceptions of themselves and how closely that's tied to their appearance. Unfortunately, that is the case for a lot of young women. How can we better understand what effect that has, and how can we differentiate physical activity from your appearance to a certain extent? So how can we make this more about an investment in your health, an investment in feeling good about yourself regardless of what you look like? You can feel accomplished because you went to the gym or you went for a walk. It clears your head. It reduces stress. All of the physical and mental benefits that really don't have anything to do with appearance, because you're absolutely right. It isn't about that. And really what we try to promote in public health, and I'm a psychologist, but a lot of my work really has public health implications. Really what we're trying to do in public health is promote the minimum or the normative of being healthy. What do we know is going to prolong your life and prolong the quality of your life? It's not about looking a certain way. It's not about conforming to some ideal. And if losing weight is something that would be healthy for you and would motivate you for over a certain period of time, that's great. But how do you keep it up even after you lose the weight, or even after you look the way you want to? And really pulling those two apart, I think, is what needs to happen a lot more, particularly for women. How do we promote physical activity for health, physical and mental health reasons, rather than just because I want it to make me look good?
I know we're talking about activity level here, but was there anything about eating?
Right. So two major points. One is that we also took people's weight. We actually weighed them, did their height and weight when they came in to answer our questions and to get the pedometers each time over 2 years. So we had that objective information. We also did a 3-day food recall so that we could calculate approximately how many calories they'd eaten at each of these assessments over 2 years. And we did not see the same patterns with BMI change and weight change, or with change in calorie intake, that we saw with perceptions of overeating and perceptions of body image. So this really is the way that you think about yourself. It's not even necessarily the reality of your behavior or responding to actual changes in your weight. What you're responding to is the way you think and feel about yourself. And I think that is really important and potentially more malleable than just talking about changing your weight or changing the amount of calories that you're eating. We really need to be focused much more on the way that women think about themselves and the way that they talk to themselves about their behaviors and about their weight. And one thing that we didn't assess, but one of the things that my research team is really invested in on our campus, is making sure that people have knowledge of what resources are available on and near campus. It's not just on campus, but how do you actually get people to explore the areas around their campus? We have a gorgeous park not even a mile from our campus that not a lot of students ever visit because they don't really know about it. So one of the ways that campuses can really promote healthy behavior beyond just going to the gym is helping students understand what are all the resources that are available and making sure that information is available to them in ways that maybe we wouldn't ordinarily think of. So do they have to go specifically look for that information, or is it available to them pretty much in classroom buildings, in their dorms? Do their RAs know about it? Getting to them where they actually are. One other just sort of side note is that we had our participants using pedometers. So what we were collecting was their overall level of physical activity. It wasn't just going to the gym. So that was embedded in there for sure. But we were also looking at just were they going for a leisurely, slow walk that wouldn't necessarily be the same as going to the gym. And reminding especially young women that you don't have to be going to the gym 5 days a week for an hour to be healthy, that going out for a walk and just taking a break from studying every once in a while, even if you're not getting your heart rate up, that that's still really good for you.
That was Dr. Danielle Arrigo, assistant professor of psychology at the University of Scranton and lead author of a study that examines factors that predict college women's physical activity over 2 years. Michelle Obama's garden can keep churning out vegetables at the White House. That's the official word from the Trump White House. First Lady Melania Trump says through a spokeswoman that she is committed to preserving and continuing White House gardens and specifically mentions Mrs. Obama's kitchen garden. The former First Lady planted the garden in 2009 as the foundation for her signature initiative Let's Move, which she designed to help reduce childhood obesity through diet and exercise. The garden produced hundreds of pounds of fruits and vegetables yearly. Some of it helped feed the Obama family and guests at White House events and supply neighborhood food kitchens. Mrs. Obama referred to the garden as her baby and said she hoped future presidents would keep it going. Now a scientist tells us about planetary hygiene.
Spacecraft hygiene. I'm Bob Hirshon, and this is Science Update. The NASA Office of Planetary Protection is sort of a high-tech janitorial service, cleaning and checking spacecraft for bacteria and their tough spores. Betsy Pugel is deputy to the Planetary Protection Officer.
So that when something goes to Mars or Enceladus or places that may have life, that we know what we're taking along in terms of a biological load.
But she says no matter how carefully they scrub, some spores manage to survive.
Nature always finds a way. You think you've cleaned something to the nth degree, and somehow, somewhere, there's something that manages to persist.
In fact, the extreme efforts the group takes to disinfect the spacecraft have led to the discovery of new types of super tough microorganisms that survive their efforts, clues to the very sorts of microbes that might live on other worlds. I'm Bob Hirshon for AAAS, the Science Society.
Weeks after the election of Donald Trump, some minority women are turning their fears into action by joining hundreds, possibly thousands of women of color who are actively considering a run for office. Across the country, women are gathering signatures, attending workshops, and signing up for fundraising and public speaking classes, with their eyes on campaigns for school board seats, city council, state offices, even Congress. Nonprofit groups that encourage women to seek office are reporting skyrocketing interest, noting jumps in workshop and webinar attendance. Vote Run lead director Erin Villardi says group-sponsored webinars like From Protester to Politician typically get 50 to 100 participants. Since November, the webinars are attracting more than 1,000 participants each time, and about half are women of color. Award-winning Indian-born American author Bharati Mukherjee penned novels that told stories about life as an immigrant. She died at the end of January at age 76. KALW Sandeep Roy remembers her.
During the 20 years I've been in California, an immigrant fog of South Asians has crept into America.
That's writer Bharati Mukherjee reading from her novel, The Tree Bride. Mukherjee was one of the earliest chroniclers of that story of the immigrant fog changing America. I just found out she died a couple of weeks ago in Manhattan. This is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata. I knew Bharati Mukherjee when she lived in San Francisco and taught at UC Berkeley. Mukherjee was elegant in her sari with a glass of red wine, but you would be a fool to not see the steel behind those Kolkata convent school manners. She had led a sheltered life in Kolkata, but had vivid memories of India around the time of independence.
I had grown up as a very small girl watching funeral processions of young people killed during the freedom fighting riots.
She resented the colonial attitudes of the Irish nuns at her Catholic school, and she was relieved she came to America, not England, the old colonial power.
for me, coming to America rather than Britain was a sense of relief, was great freedom. The untying, uncoupling of English from colonial history was very, very liberating.
It was liberating in other ways, too.
When I'm writing fiction, I can only think in English or American English. I'm making this anti-colonial distinction between the two. And that probably because I can be free to be any character I want in English, whereas I am stuck, I'm constrained, restrained to be the good, well-brought-up Bengali woman if I write in Bengali.
She came to America at a time when that immigrant fog had not yet crept in.
When I came in the early 60s, there were very few Indians who were immigrants. We were all came as foreign students on the foreign student visa. And the numbers were so small, even in places like Manhattan, that you would smile at another Indian if you walked by one.
She wrote those first stories of these new Americans in books like The Middleman and Other Stories, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award way back in 1988. In Tiger's Daughter, an Indian woman feels out of place in India after years in America. In her famous novel Jasmine, Jyoti becomes Jasmine, becomes Jane, stripping away layers of identity with each name as she journeys from India to Iowa.
By the time I came to write Jasmine, say, in the late 80s, Indian immigrants were far more visible as a community. But the rhetoric for talking about immigration was still stuck in that old melting pot versus rejection of American culture.
The melting pot assumed a one-way transformation, she said, an assimilation where all the non-Anglos were expected to scrub down. She was interested in the two-way process where America changed her, even as she changed America. This two-way dance preoccupied her later books, like The Tree Bride.
And so it tabulates the regrets and the limitedness of the concept of free will that had been embraced by some of my earlier characters, like Jasmine. And this may make some people, some Americans, unhappy, but it's understanding the dance of free will and destiny.
She wrote about those hyphenated lives, but rejected the hyphen for herself. She wanted to be an American writer, she said, not an Asian American one, relegated to a particular bookshelf. My rejection of hyphenation has been called race treachery, she said. But it is really a demand that America deliver the promises of its dream to all its citizens equally. But her rejection of the hyphen was not a rejection of her roots. In one of her last books, Mukherjee's heroine Tara turns on the lights in her San Francisco home at dusk because her grandmother in India once told her, "The spirits come out at that time." Mukherjee told me she too did the same.
What is there in science to tell me at this moment to tell me that spirits don't exist? So I'm turning on the lights even more vigorously these days.
Bharati Mukherjee is gone, but she left the light on for many of us. This is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata.
Chura liya hai tumne jo dil ko.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1440.